Hey, everybody. The holidays made this one very difficult to record, and so you should know this is a two-parter. The first part of it is what the mini-pod normally is, preview of the upcoming game against the Vikings, and then we take questions in part two. So when part one ends, don't turn it off. Part two will start up right then. There is a separate mini-pod on the Patreon for those of you who are Patreon subscribers. Go check that out, too. It is different than the start of this podcast. It is about different things. So go check out both of those. We'll be back next week. Enjoy the show. Everybody, welcome to the mini pod, or maybe the regular pod, we'll see, for the upcoming game against the Minnesota Vikings. I'm Paul Noonan of Acme Packing Company and the Shepherd Express. There's a couple parts to this week's reporting is eligible flying around, and if you don't hear it on the main feed, it'll be on the Patreon feed or vice versa. We're giving away some for free, but you know, we gotta do right by our patrons too. So everybody gets a fun one. We're taking questions. They'll be appended to one of these. And so stick around for that. Go and find it. If you do want to join the Patreon and get the mini pod and also the baseball minor league extra with James Anderson and Ryan, that is the $5 package. I think we call it the ball and glove. I don't remember. It's $5. $5 a month. You get the mini pod preview every Friday when the Packers are going up to play a team. There'll be at least this plus one more. If they make the playoffs, there'll be more than that. There'll be like a season wrap-up one, too. That's what you're looking at there. But let's get to it. Usually, if you're not familiar, if we're playing a team and we're the underdog, try and explain how we can win that game. If we're the favorite, try and explain what's likely to happen that could cause us to lose this game, which has happened a lot lately and has been dead on. I'm good at those. The Vikings and the Packers are, I think, a pretty even Steven, even with the Vikings beat up pretty hard. Not that we're not, like, our injury list is also very, very long. I shouldn't even say that that's a big Viking thing. That's probably a good enough place to start. We got a lot of limited people, but I think the important people will likely play. Like, Devondre Campbell's probably out, but that's a whole problem anyway, and that's probably addition by subtraction. Aaron Jones is still on the injury report with a knee and a finger, but given how he played last week, I suspect he'll end up going. He is limited, though. You never know with Aaron. AJ is still limited. If they don't have running backs, that is a problem, but I think they will. Luke Musgrave has been activated, and actually he's been limited too with his kidney laceration. He's going to play at some point. I don't know if he's going to get in this one, but it would be nice if he did. Jaden Reed, he's still limited, but his comments today sound like he is ready to go. So I expect him to be fully healthy. That's very, very good. That's very helpful. Darnell Savage still nursing a shoulder. Who knows? And again, not the biggest deal. Quay Walker actually does matter kind of a lot. He's limited too. And then we got Watson and Wicks. I think Wicks will go, but he was on the bike today. Watson, I think maybe a little bit longer. It's still the hamstring, so you never know. I hope Wicks plays. He helps a lot when he's in there. I think he hurt when he got knocked out last week. That offense, it took it. It was definitely a downgrade without him in there. They need a little bit more depth in the receiving core. Hopefully Wicks can go. But here's the thing, and we'll get to the Viking injuries in a second. The path to victory for the Vikings, not to say that they're big underdogs, but the path to victory for the Vikings is to continue to play super great defense and hold the Packer offense, which has been good lately, in check. And then use the meager parts of their offense that they still have that are healthy to overwhelm Joe Barry through guile and score enough points to get this one done. I think that's pretty realistic. Kevin O'Connell is a good play caller. They are beat up on offense, something serious, but I think even with bad players, if you can do some of the same exploits that Carolina and Tampa and New York did to us over the last 3 weeks, then you can probably get the job done. And it's just a matter of having a couple of guys healthy. You can do that. Justin Jefferson is going to play in this game. And the one guy I didn't mention for the Packers, Jaire Alexander, is suspended in this game for being an idiot last week. Now, listen to the other pod for lots more on that, and all what may have prompted it. But, you know, that's what it comes down to fundamentally, is the Vikings have enough weapons with just Jefferson to maybe get this done if their defense continues to play as it is. And let's talk about that defense, because their defense has been a phenomenal story. They were 25th in DVOA last year. They were pretty much the same as us. Unlike us, they fired their defensive coordinator, former Packer defensive coordinator Ed Donatell, who ran the 25th best defense in the league last year. They fired him despite going 13-4, which teams don't always have the guts to do. They hired Brian Flores, the former head coach of the Miami Dolphins, who, if you may recall, ended up suing the NFL in various employment and discrimination capacities. He is African-American. He was fired by the Dolphins, despite I think he had a maybe slightly under 500 record, or close to 500 record, but his last two seasons were winning seasons, and he was working with not great talent there. So Brian Flores was freed up. The Vikings saw that he was freed up. They moved on from Donatell to him. He's been absolutely outstanding as a defensive coordinator, and I don't mean to, there is no hyperbole there. Not only has he been outstanding, they're fifth in DVOA this year. They're like 12th in EPA per play, but they're like tied with the 49ers defense. It's pretty crunched up there. It doesn't take much to move around in the top 12. And more than anything, they're innovative on defense. They are crazy pants. If you go and look at some of PFF or Football Outsiders analysis on the Vikings defense this year, they are the most unique defense of the last 5 years. What makes them unique is that they blitz and they drop eight into coverage more than any other team in the league by just a ton. I will put this chart in, I will either retweet it. I'm going to retweet it right now as I record this. Check it out later on. There's a chart. I'll do the best I can. It's not a visual medium. That Dan Pizzuta put together, and it was retweeted by Nate Tice, who's a good analyst, of the drop eight rate and the blitz rate. Blitz rate is the horizontal axis. Drop rate is the vertical axis of all the teams in the NFL this year. The team that blitzes the second most is the New York Giants at about 41%. And the team that drops eight the second most is the New Orleans Saints, who do it at about 12%. The Minnesota Vikings blitz on 47% of their defensive snaps, which is the Giants are actually kind of close, but nobody, the Giants and Buccaneers, and then it's a huge, huge gap, and it's a huge gap between the Vikings and the Giants. And the Vikings drop eight, which we usually rally against, but I'll get to it in a second, 22% of the time, 10% more than the Saints do. They are on an island unto themselves on this chart. It is really quite the chart. Go look it up. It'll be in my feed very high. And blitzing and running a unique defense and dropping it can all blow up in your face. But the reason it works for the Vikings is because most teams bring four or five rushers most of the time. And so if you're preparing for most teams, most offensive line checks and pass off responsibilities and things like that will be for four and five rushers. You practice those, you know those inside and out. You know, generally speaking, what you're going to have to do. There might be a novelty trick play, bring the house blitz every once in a while. People might drop eight once in a while. But by and large, you know, offensive linemen can rely on the usual and their muscle memory to make the proper checks and pass-offs and all that fun stuff. It's kind of a bell curve if you think about it. It's going to be four and five. That's most of what you're going to have to deal with. The threes, not as much. The six-plus, not as much. When you play the Vikings, that bell curve gets real flat. They bring the house a lot. They bring a whole bunch of blitzers a lot, and they're just as likely to drop a whole ton of people into coverage. And, of course, if you know that they're dropping a whole ton of people into coverage and there's only three people rushing and you recognize that immediately, you can, you know, sit in the pocket forever and wait for guys to come open. Where the Vikings get super effective, though, is A, in disguising how many people are coming, and B, blitzing so much and so heavily that quarterbacks start to panic, and that clock speeds up even with three rushers coming, and they end up forcing balls into eight-man coverages, and mistakes happen that way. It's very creative. It's actually pretty fun to watch. I know watching the Vikings play defense probably isn't high on any of your wants for the year, but I actually recommend doing it because it is really something. And it's amazing how much dropping eight does work for them. In fact, Aaron Schatz at Outsiders did a little analysis, and the Vikings are actually, even though they blitz a ton and at a very high rate and bring a lot of people, they're actually a more effective defense when not blitzing. It's the fear of the blitz that works best for them. And the challenge for Jordan Love, he's been good at this, but the challenge will be to stay very calm and diagnose every play individually, not based on what he's seen recently. Not panic when it's only three or four coming at you. Use those opportunities to hit big plays down the field. Teams have had a problem doing that against the Vikings. Quarterbacks have gotten very panicky against them, and it has been very difficult. The Vikings are also a very well-rounded defense. They are sixth against the pass, fifth or sixth against the pass, and like ninth against the run. It's not like this isn't a game where you can just like lean on Aaron Jones. Last week, Carolina was one of the worst run defenses in the league, and thank goodness for it. You could, when things weren't working, just lean on Aaron, and you would do a pretty good job just doing that. That's not the case this week. And if Aaron even is good to go and not on a snap count, he's always a weapon, but he's not going to be a guy who can just take this one over in all likelihood. They're going to be able to need to pass to score points. This is a unique defense. It's tricky. It gave the Packers fits the first time they saw it this year. Should pull that game up and make sure I'm not lying about that. We were bad in that game, right? I'm not crazy. That was Halloween. Oh yeah, we lost that game 24-10. We scored 10 points last time we saw this defense play. Jordan Love was 24 of 41 for 229, one touchdown and a pick. That's not good. Jaden Reed was everything. Christian Watson was terrible. Dontavian was actually, he was okay, but he was not great. And Romeo had like the most inefficient day of all time. 9 targets, 4 catches, 18 yards and a score. Yeesh. The score is good, but the rest of that, ugh. So the defense also seems to have really reinvigorated some of the older Vikings in terms of just pure production. Danielle Hunter is having first of all, he's been hurt a lot. He has not been hurt this season. The Vikings have suffered a lot of injuries on offense. But on defense, Danielle has been healthy. He's got 15.5 sacks. He has been an absolute force. He is obviously capable of creating pass rush all by his lonesome. He is phenomenal. He is their fourth highest grade on the PFF list, though, because Mekkie Blackman, who may not play at cornerback, and Cameron Bynum, their safety, are higher. And I think that goes to show you just how much they're getting out of guys who Mekkie Blackman's a third-round rookie and is by PFF the best defensive player, and their DVOA splits, I think, kind of agree with that, where their DVOA splits are unusual. I haven't seen this kind of. So they're good against number one receivers, and I think that does make sense. Their top corner tends to be either Blackman or he plays a little in the slot, but he also plays backup left corner to a guy whose name is escaping me right now. Because he's been hurt. Byron Murphy. Byron Murphy. He's also hurt. That number one corner has been good for them. Number two, though, is their weakness. And their pass rush helps to cover up the fact that you have to get to a second read to actually do a lot of damage against them. They're like 20-something. Lost my DVOAs. I made a mistake, tactically speaking. I usually line up all my spreadsheets in a big row, so I can just... I went back to look at something, and I was like, I'll find it right away. Nope, that's not what happened. That was stupid. Shouldn't have done that. Lost my order. I will reset the order. Here we are. Vikings. 23rd against number two receivers. So that's where you can do your damage. And that's partially that they are hurt, and they have been hurt. And so they're a little top-heavy. Their safeties are good at helping on the number one receiver, Bynum, etc. But number two, if you can actually hold the ball long enough, you can do damage on the other side of the field. But they're good against the slot, too. Only eighth against the slot. Reed actually won one of the better slot games against them earlier this year. Struggle a little bit with tight ends at 16th. If Kraft shows up, that would be big. And pass catching running backs. If Aaron Jones is going to do some damage in this game, that's a good place for it. They really specialize at taking away a team's number one receiver and slot receiver. That's a very analytically good way to go about things. Slot receivers are usually highly targeted. They can do a lot of damage. Number one receivers are number one receivers. Going to the second outside receiver is not everybody's forte. Relying on the tight end is a lot of people's forte. That's why the Vikings aren't perfect. But, like, that's where you have to attack them. The Packers are capable of this. Like, this is not, like, a thing where, like, I think Matt LaFleur is necessarily going to, not be able to get this done here. There are weaknesses to pick on. But it's been a problem for a lot of teams putting up numbers against the Vikings. And so it is a tough challenge that they will have to overcome because, of course, on the other side of the ball, you got to stop Minnesota's offense from scoring points. And if you're Joe Barry, you haven't been able to stop Jack anything from scoring points. So if their defense could do what they did last time to us, hold us to 10 points or 17 points or even 21 points, you don't have to get that many points to win the game. Now, the Viking offense is coming off one of their worst games of the season, kind of. They lost to the Lions 30-24, still scored 24 points. Nick Mullins exploded. He threw four interceptions. He got sacked four times. He got destroyed by the Lions pass rush, threw a bunch of stupid bad balls. But they were still effective in doing some things that I think should scare the Packers, one of which is leaning heavily on Justin Jefferson and getting him into space, especially getting him into space. They targeted him 10 times. He only caught six balls, but he caught six balls for 141 yards and a score. And they were able to actually coax a good game out of KJ Osborne, who's only okay, who had 5 for 95 and a score. This was really a shootout game. Detroit's defense isn't good at preventing yards. They rely on turnovers, which they got. We're working with Nick Mullins, Justin Jefferson, Ty Chandler, KJ Osborne, and they still put up 24 points. As bad as Mullins was turning the ball over, he threw for 411 yards in that game. And, you know, you start thinking, like, well, it's Jaron Hall. It's not Nick Mullins, who's at least a seasoned veteran. Hockenson's out for the year, who had a decent enough game last time. Is this really going to be the same kind of thing? And then, maybe not, but we have Joe on the other side. And the one other thing the Vikings do have, first of all, they suck at rushing the ball. They really, really do. They're really bad at it. Oh, that's a fun one. I forgot about that game. Alexander Mattison, as bad as he is a decent enough pass catcher where you can do some of the motion things that the three teams that have given us trouble recently did and get Jefferson singled up in zone on someone who shouldn't be guarding him. They have enough, Ham, is he healthy? I don't know. He's not on this one. If he's healthy enough, like, he's actually a good pass catcher too. Like, Ham and Mattison together, I should actually look and see if he's playing. Allow them to do a lot of the same things that people have done against us recently. And if we're counting on Joe Barry to learn, it hasn't happened yet. big drink of water. Yep, CJ Ham did play last week, had one catch for 6 yards. Fullback gives you trouble if you can't stop the run and is also a dangerous pass catcher in some instances. So, like, this is a team that really is lacking in offensive talent. Like, it's very possible Addison is going to miss this game. It's very possible. Well, Hockenson is going to miss. He's done for the year. It's just Justin Jefferson and Scrubs. And so the obvious thing to do, if you are Joe Barry, is to cover the hell out of Justin Jefferson. And if you do that, you probably win this game. If you don't do that, though, if you do your stupid zone, if you stay true to your philosophy and, you know, devote people to taking away the Josh Olivers of the world, the Brandon Powells, who the hell is Brandon Powell? He had 53 yards receiving last week. I should probably know who he is. I do not. And if you let KJ go off, because he has, like, Devondre Campbell's not going to play, but, like, Quay on him. Well, that's a problem, and they're good at this. So it's going to be Jaren Hall, who's not good. He only has one weapon of any scary at all. But their defense is good, and their defense can keep this close. And if they can then coax a couple drives, and Hall is mobile, like a couple of good runs out of Jaren Hall and a couple of deep shots to Justin Jefferson, or we just don't cover Justin Jefferson. They hit him over and over and over again. They can score enough points to win this game. They're a scary team because they're smart, even though they're hurt. They can still make the playoffs. They can still, I don't think they can do any damage, but they can prove that they are actually a good team. And they are honestly kind of scary now and going forward. This is a must-win for the Packers. They can't afford to be stupid. I wish they would have moved on from Joe, you know, this week slash last week slash the week before that. But Joe around makes anything possible. This game is scary for that reason. Minnesota is super, super limited but smart, and that's all it takes against Joe Barry. Good defense plus smart offensive coordinator, I think, is a tough spot for the Packers to be in, and I'm not sure what's going to happen in this one. So I will leave it at that. There will be a separate part of this where we answer questions. Hopefully I'll have at least Matt around. Other than that, enjoy the game. We'll be back next week, win, lose, or anything else. Dance, cannons, planner. Never got used to this bitter winter. I've been wasted, angry and sad since you left Minneapolis. I wish my thoughts were pure like the driven snow.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
I must be dumb. She had a pocket full of horses, Trojan and some of them here. But it was Saturday now, I guess that makes it alright. She said, what have I got to lose? And honey, I said, little red Corvette, baby, you're much too fast. Little red Corvette, you need love.
Hey everybody, welcome to, I guess, part three of Reporting is Eligible this week. If you are looking for part two, it's right before this. And if you're looking for part one, that is the Patreon exclusive part today. So you can see that at patreon.com/MKETailgate. This is, of course, the question section, because all of you love writing questions. We love answering them. And so we're just going to get to that right away. The first two are solo shows. But to help me answer questions, we managed to get together during the daytime of a work week holiday. Who we got there?
My name is Matt. You can call me Matt, Acme Packing Company, Meme Weaver, and general Twitter rabble rouser. Currently working from home. So, of course, I'm here.
Also working from home. So, yeah, this is lunch break. So, anyway, thanks for everybody for their questions. We got the Vikings game upcoming. We just kind of barely squeaked by the Panthers, which was something. The Pop-Tarts Bowl happened yesterday, if you're wondering when we're recording this. Matt, did you see any of the Pop-Tarts Bowl or just the memes?
I mean, the fact that the mascot sacrificed himself to become an edible trophy is it perfectly encapsulates Gen Z's Doom-based culture.
Yeah.
So
I could see it having good with appeal to old school too, though. Like sacrifice for the greater good, old school religion we got going here. Lots of subtext.
Oh, sure.
Here. It was
but yeah, so
really
very
something.
Specifically. Well, from what I understand, is it has created a resurgence of the brand with Gen Z because the Doomers are just out in waves,
yeah,
supporting the Pop-Tarts.
I think that makes perfect sense. I think it was great. Like that, whoever thought of that deserves the biggest of promotions ever. Like, who would think pitching that? Like we're gonna have a bowl game, and during the bowl game, we're gonna have a Pop-Tart mascot. And at the end of the game, the winning team's going to eat him. That is insane. And it worked great.
But it also, I mean, to me, it's very reminiscent of when the Wendy's social media person just decided to start being a jerk to people.
Yeah, it's like, very similar.
Right, like completely out of left field. No one thought to do it before. And now I feel like we're going to have a lot of copycats.
Yeah, and they're all going to be worse than this because this was executed brilliantly as well. The very earnest Pop-Tart who knew he was going to die is like also quite the good choice to make. All right. We got lots of questions and we got limited time because it's the daytime. So let's knock these puppies out. Do you want to?
Oh, man. Oh, you just retweeted it. I was like, someone already made it turns out the Pop-Tart was at the January 6th.
Andy Schaff retweeted it into my timeline. So,
oh, man.
So good. Milkshake
duck
that guy. All right, you want to be the reader or the answerer?
I will
alternate.
Be the reader.
Okay,
I'll be the reader since I can put on my business voice because it's business hours,
yeah.
Right?
It is business time. Oh, yeah.
All right, beginning questions from our patrons. Patrons get question priority as always. And number one, as usual, is Mark Podskarby.
As always.
Based on metrics like CPOE and completion percentage, Jordan Love has gone from wildly inaccurate to one of the most accurate passers in the NFL if you compare his first half and his second half splits. What do you attribute this development towards, and is it sustainable?
It's nuts. Yeah, it's very surprising. Yeah. I think he has cleaned up his mechanics a little bit on short throws, and I think most of it is from a Love perspective, short throws, but I think a lot of it is just the receivers got better, and we really should give them a lot of blame for the early season woes that he had, which is fine. They're all rookies and second-year players. But as they've developed and catch radiuses have developed, they've really helped boost that completion percentage too. I would say the other big one recently is Tucker Kraft is better at catching short passes than Luke Musgrave is, and there kind of are a lot of them. So it's two or three a game, but it actually does matter, I feel like, materially to that.
Sure. Yeah. The other thing is I think it also does lend itself to things that we were saying about him earlier in the year, like back in October, where remember I said that it's like he's aiming the ball, not throwing it,
yeah,
like, to use the baseball terminology. It seems like he's much more like just throwing
he's
it.
Winging
like
he's winging it now, yeah.
Yeah,
and I think
that's kind of where he shines.
Yeah, I think it is sustainable. I do think he kind of every once in a while will fall back into bad habits and get into his own head a little bit, and you can kind of see that. So like if he ever went into a little bit of a slump, I wouldn't be that surprised. But I think as long as he has his wits about him and he is just letting it fly out there, that it probably is sustainable. Like it looks good. It's good to see.
Oh, man. And that 3rd and 10 where he's like fading away, completely sidearm wings it. Oh, my God.
So good. So good.
So beautiful.
The wild plays
to a moving
really
target.
Good. Yeah.
Ugh. All right. Donald Anderson update. The Packers have gone 0 games since receiving a personal foul.
Yes.
It was too good to last. And when it didn't even last one whole series.
It sure didn't.
It did not.
Rough game.
Here's
on
the question.
Part.
Yeah, that was rough. Here's the question. Did Brian Gutekunst ultimately doom this season by trading Rasul Douglas? It seems he was the team's most reliable defensive back, yet trading him didn't make the team better in 2023. Was a 2024 draft upgrade from 5th to 3rd round worth more than the 2023 playoff berth?
I don't think he doomed the team. Rasul's good, but I don't think that their corner play really took that big of a hit when he was gone. Like he was replaced basically with Valentine, who played pretty much as well as he did, and it got Corey Ballantyne more time. But I don't even think he's terrible. He's just like, you know, averagey okay, which is fine.
Yeah.
Honestly, the biggest guys who deserve blame other than Joe Barry in the secondary are older guys. Like Jair has played like garbage in the rare instances he's been out there. Stokes is bad. Like I might be out on Stokes. I think he is all athletes and no technique, and given all the injuries, I'm not sure that's going to work. And, then that's the other thing. Yeah.
Do you remember who else was all athlete and no technique? And then
Kevin
got
King.
Robbed him of athleticism.
About.
Yes. Stokes is just the second coming of Kevin King, and that's kind of sad.
But like their lower tier guys, I think, are better than their upper tier guys at this point, and I have very little faith. I think Alexander is complicated, and that if he decides he wants to play good in any given week and within the scheme, he will. But he just doesn't always do. He goes for Jair a lot of the time and not the team a lot of the time. So,
and I mean, he also plays very much like Deion Sanders in that, like, if he's feeling sore that day, he ain't tackling.
Yep.
Like. The other thing is, Donald said, it sure seems as if Joe Barry doesn't trust his DBs. And that's Hanlon's razor.
Yeah.
Don't attribute to malice what can be attributed to ignorance. Like, I don't think he doesn't trust his DBs. I just think he's dumb.
I agree with that. I do. This is actually talked about in the other podcasts that will be stitched to this one way or another a little bit. But the Vikings do not have a strong bevy of corners on their team. They are mostly very, very young. I don't have the Our Lads up in front of me right now, so I have forgotten one of their names, but their third round pick from this year is like their best corner. And they protect their corners by mercilessly harassing the quarterback who's throwing at them. Whereas Joe seems to protect his corners by giving them like 10-yard cushions. That is not helping. That is doing the opposite of helping. And I think it is a big risk-averse problem that a lot of defensive coordinators have, and Barry has in spades. So I think that there's probably some truth in that question. He doesn't trust his DBs, but he doesn't know how to deal with not trusting his DBs properly, whereas Brian Flores does.
Right. It also feels like Joe Barry wants 8 DBs all at the same time. Have 3 down linemen and 8 DBs. Yeah. Actually, 1 down lineman, 2 linebackers, and 8 DBs.
Yeah. Is that guy's name Mekhi Blackman? Is that right? That guy's good.
Mekhi Becton?
Thank you. Yes.
Jonathan Deal. Who makes the offense look better, Joe Barry or Kyle Shanahan? I think we all saw that Brock Turdy was out there the other night.
That's true. So, he showed up.
Yeah. I don't know if Kyle Shanahan is infallible. He definitely, I mean, it's really funny that people talk about Brock Purdy, right? Like, they say that he's out there Paul, were we thinking of two different people?
Mekhi Blackman is the third round corner for the, not Mekhi Becton, who is a different player altogether.
Yeah. I was like, that's, Kyle Shanahan's out there with basically like the Avengers, and then like Bruce Banner is instead of the Hulk is out there. But yeah, Joe Barry makes everybody look like the Avengers.
He really does. Crap. Yeah. I guess I lean. Well, here's the thing though with Barry though. He does seem to be good against the Chiefs. Mm-hmm. So, I don't, they're kind of the same, aren't they? They're just two sides of the same coin.
Joe Barry is very good against elite quarterbacks, but the fact that there's only like 2 or 3 left in the league, it's you need to be good against the common denominator.
Yeah. Also, if the elite quarterbacks had better offensive coordinators, and not to disparage Andy Reid, but if they just played the Purdy game for a day against the Packers, they'd tear them a new one instead of trying to do too much cool stuff. I guess I lean Barry here, though Shanny's obviously awesome. They're pretty much just two sides of the same coin. Monitor, anti-monitor, Thanos, the opposite of Thanos, whatever that is. Oh, there is an opposite of Thanos, because it's the Eros, but he's a dirtbag. You know, it's funny. Marvel has, do you know the Thanos origin story in Marvel?
Vaguely.
So Thanos is from Titan, like the moon of Jupiter, with a bunch of other people who are Titans. And he's like the evil mutant one, and he was like picked on as a kid. But he's got a brother. So Thanos means death. And he has a brother named Eros. And Eros means love. However, in Marvel canon, Eros is like a dirtbag and I would say fairly categorized as a rapist.
Because
his power is he can talk people into doing things. And, you know, back in the 70s and 80s when comic book writers didn't think so hard about what they were actually doing, that happened a lot. So yeah, that's how that is. So he's actually probably as big, if not a bigger monster than Thanos. So Thanos' opposite is also a scumbag, so he doesn't actually have an opposite.
I just love that in the Marvel Universe, they have a villain who literally eats planets, and they only bust him out every once in a while. It's because, like, oh, you're going to ruin the whole universe. So
there is that. He's tricky, so too. He's in the Fantastic Four movie, right? So they don't like to talk about him anymore.
It's true.
Yeah.
All right. JD says, Jordan looked like he is a consistent top 10 QB in the league, question mark. Sub question, how did this Rashid Walker turnaround happen?
Yeah. Jordan, first of all, quarterbacking's garbage right now, so Jordan absolutely looks like that at the moment. And he's been pretty consistent for a while now. His physical tools are really good. The team's super young. It's hard to see him backsliding too much. It's not like they're going to get... This is not a team of old people who is going to get drastically worse next year. This is a team of young people who may plateau for a little bit, but yeah, he should be good. He looks good. Yes, is the answer. Rashid Walker, we're good at this. We're good at turning offensive linemen into good offensive linemen. We do it all the time. We shouldn't actually be that surprised about it. He's still not great at run blocking, just physical tools, and that's partially a Packer preference. They don't like big monsters who are road graders. They like guys who pass protect. That's actually smart. That's how they get a lot of deals on guys. But Stanovich is good at that. And I mean, maybe he actually finally devoted some time to what he's good at this year.
Yeah, they definitely do good with tackles that just look like, you know, tight ends who are on a bulking diet.
Yep.
And also, I think the big thing with Walker is his misses have become less catastrophic.
Yeah.
So he was good 80% of the time, but then that 20% was awful. And he brought his 20% up to mediocre, which then makes him look amazing.
I would also put out there, while he has been good, he has not been as good as the PFF grades of the last 4 or 5 weeks have made him out to be, which is like one of the two best tackles in football. He's not that. Like, nobody who's that bad at run blocking can be one of the best two tackles in football. The best tackles in football are good at everything. So, grains of salt on PFF grades. They like to have things to talk about too. But yeah, he has been legitimately good.
Mm-hmm. But has he also gone one-on-one against any elite pass rushers?
I don't think so. The Kayvon Thibodeau is okay. Did Tampa have Levante in that game? Not that he's even super elite anyway.
But the Tampa, I mean, their interior is going to be...
That's what's providing a lot of the pressure.
Kind of monstrous, yeah.
And it's not like Carolina has any giant, awesome guys. Their best pass rusher play is middle linebacker at the moment.
Man, I remember what that's like.
Yeah. Same. Actually worked really well.
It super did.
Yeah.
Oh, man, Clay complained about that so much, though. Remember he said, I like hitting quarterbacks, not fullbacks?
Yep.
That's my favorite quote. Okay, so Jay Google says, so is Jair looking for a way out, or is he just trying to make Joe Barry look bad? This thing's weird, right?
We can never know. So, and I think I did this on one of the other podcasts, stitched this too, but a fair reading of the evidence about Jair. Like, first of all, I don't like to assume anybody's, like, faking injury or going soft. Just don't like to do it. However, I take this back to last year, to the first Vikings game of 2022, October 29th, 2022, where Jair Alexander does not guard Justin Jefferson. He is basically there in zone. The Vikings do this thing that just happened to Joe Barry for the last 3 weeks. They basically spread everybody out, run motion to get Jefferson on not Jair, usually Stokes. Stokes covered him, I think, 2/3 of the game. And had like 184 yards and 2 touchdowns in that game, and the Packers lost horribly. And then what happened? Jair Alexander complained to Joe Barry, mm-hmm. and the team actually changed how they play defense based on that conversation for the next game, where Justin Jefferson was held to one catch for 15 yards, I think, on 5 targets, if memory serves, off the top of my head. So Jair is not above expressing his displeasure with the scheme and moving to change it. There has been, I would say, a lot of scheme regression this year, and you know, the guy's not shy. So I don't think he's been tanking things, but if he was, I wouldn't be that surprised that he was tanking things, because he is an activist in the locker room, and he is a strange person, and he's done some strange things and had strange behavior. So who knows?
But I also find him to be incredibly honest. He doesn't generally do the like foreboding cryptic Instagram stuff, like what Jair thinks Jair says, right? Like, I don't know if he has it in him to be, you know, the is it running backs or wide receivers?
Wide receivers.
He doesn't have the wide receiver tweets in him. The enemy speaks kindly and carries a knife.
Carries a knife.
Like, that's not Jay.
That is true.
Okay. Old man on a bike in Shirlington. Man, I missed you. I'm just an old man on a bike, but I like what I've seen from this year's Packers. Granted, we need to make some changes in the offseason to include replacing Joe Barry and Simone Biles' husband. But otherwise, it seems we are well positioned for years of success. Now, some of you may call out SBH after this game. Well, my wife brought to my attention that SBH made some waves last week on the TikTok after he seemingly objected to being most known for being married to Simone Biles. Now, no one outside of his immediate family would recognize SBH at a Piggly Wiggly, whereas Simone Biles is a national treasure and the most decorated Olympic gymnast. Indeed, all one needs to do is compare their Wikipedia pages where SBH touts his high school glory days and time spent on the NFL practice squads, while Simone Biles goes on and on for winning international championships. If FBH does not understand who wears the tights in their relationship, there is no way he can understand modern NFL offenses and simply needs to go. All that said, I echo the commenter from last week who had no more questions about this squad. So instead, I want to talk about the about activities for the family in Green Bay as I flew in for Christmas. Okay, you're going to have to help me with this city.
Either way, I would say.
As an Alloway native, I'm a big fan of Zesties, and of course, there is a new Titletown district. But I've been gone for a few years. So, what else should I do with the family while I'm in town?
Boy, you're asking the wrong podcast here, guy.
Okay, so the first half, So for those who didn't see the interview with, I can't remember the name of the podcast. It's like I see clips from this podcast all the time, like on YouTube Shorts.
I did not see it, so I don't even know.
Okay, so basically, it's a former player podcast. And what's this, Ryan something. So they're like interviewing him and Simone Biles was there and he's talking about how they met and like they matched on Tinder and he didn't know who she was. And then like, he looked up her Instagram and he's like, she's like 3 million followers. Like, what the hell? And I guess she pursued him fairly heavily in the beginnings of their relationship. And so he's like, yeah, I'm the catch. And everybody just kept giving him crap over and over again about like, are you sure you didn't know who she was? Like, really? Come on.
Yeah.
And yeah. And then the internet's just big mad about it. Okay. And, you know, that's,
was there any tongue in cheek there or was it?
I don't know.
Okay.
The interviewers kind of kept it tongue in cheek. Like, they kept giving these like hilarious, like SpongeBob faces. Like,
gotcha.
And then at the very end, they were like, hey, you guys going to have some kids? And they're like, I don't know, we're kind of seeing how our careers play out. And this one guy who's been quiet the whole time just jumps in and goes, you need to have about 11 D1 babies. And like,
jeez, okay.
And then he's giving advice on how to conceive a child. It is completely out of pocket.
All right. I'm glad I didn't see that. It sounds very awkward.
Good, man. But yeah, as for like what to do in Green Bay, man, I have no idea.
Yeah, we're not locals to Green Bay. We are expats, and I've never lived there. I've just been there a whole bunch of times. I can give advice on my whole bunch of times being there, but like, even that's not going to be as good as what the locals do, because I'm a total tourist. I go to Kroll's and get a Butterburger, and everybody knows that one. There is a hinterland that I do like in the Titletown district, and usually it isn't too bad to get into. It's right at the base of the hill, the sledding hill, and you know, there's like cool like outdoor foosball tables and stuff like that there as well. That's kind of my jam and where I tend to go. But like above and beyond that, I don't have good Green Bay business recommendations at all. I just don't. I go to two places and I go home.
Also, the biggest problem that I have is like I live in a tourist destination town, and everything that I would recommend to tourists is the stuff that locals already do and are also considered tourist traps. Like, hey, go hike this trail. Go see Garden of the Gods. Go up Pikes Peak. Like, that's crap I do.
Yeah.
So like, maybe the touristy stuff isn't really that bad.
Yeah, I do like the outdoor area right by the Kohler Hotel there. They usually have a band playing, and there's usually outdoor drinks and stuff. That's fun, especially before a night game. But yeah, like, this is not my forte. If you want to know what to do in Milwaukee, I'm all about that. And yeah, I guess Chicago some number of years ago. But yeah, I can't give recommendations in Green Bay of any usefulness. So.
Okay.
Moving on.
Richard Proctor. Is there such a thing as a, quote, just don't bend in the first place, quote, defense anymore? Or do rules changes over the last 20 years make them impossible? As a Packer fan, if I hear bend, don't break again from the new DC, I'm going to jump off a cliff.
The worst part of the bend but don't break thing is that they break a lot. Like, I feel like you're setting up a dumb numerator to make your denominator look better than it actually is by claiming to be bend but don't break. Oh, I got to dig that up. Somebody sent me a good stat that I will dig up at some point during while we're talking here and about how often they punt.
Have you seen that quadrant thing going around of like coverage variability versus how good the defense is?
No, I actually haven't seen that.
It's like one of those scatter plot charts going around and the quarters are broken up with. It's actually kind of like one of those political alignment charts. So the top left is predictable coverage, but good defense. Bottom left is predictable coverage, bad defense. Top right is unpredictable, good. Bottom right is predictable, bad.
Got it.
The bottom right, I think, is unpredictable.
Unpredictable, bad. Okay.
Yeah. And so the Washington is all the way at the bottom right. I referred to this as the Ask Madden defense because they vary so much, but they give up so much. The Browns are hyper predictable.
Yeah, yeah.
You know exactly what they're going to do, and they're great
all the time. They're just really well. They have good personnel, so they can do that.
Yeah, but they also have Jim Schwartz.
Yeah,
who's a really good DC, head coach, good DC.
Yep. A while ago, Historical Gamer, who is a Twitter follower of mine, sent me this because I was looking into this too, and like, I'm just going to read it because it'll be quicker. I was looking for some evidence of the Packers' defense being terrible beyond just points and outside of the advanced metrics, something that the layperson could understand, because they've had a few games with low point totals, and I found what I think it is. They are the second worst team in the NFL at forcing punts. They force just 3.3 punts per game. Only Denver is worse, and it's not like they're forcing turnovers, unlike Denver, who's third in turnovers forced. Green Bay is 23rd. So they're just flat out not getting off the field, letting a lot of long drives, resulting in fewer points because there's fewer opportunities, which wouldn't be so bad if it didn't also limit Green Bay's offensive opportunities as well. And by the way, Green Bay also lets opponents have the longest drives in the league on an average of 3 minutes and 1 second. That one I did look up myself. They just slow the game down, keep the score low, but require the offense to be perfect to have a chance a lot of the time. So they don't force punts. And so that's the thing. Like, they break. They bend and then they break. So, yeah, it's stupid. And here's the thing. Every defense is going to be at least a little bit bend but don't break for simple reasons of physics. When the other team is starting at their own 25-yard line, there's 75 yards of field to guard, and it's harder to guard 75. You know, defense gets easier as you go down the field just by the nature of how defense works. But yeah, good defenses will make stops well before you get into scoring range. That's the entire point of defense. And the Packers don't do that. Letting somebody get down to the 10-yard line routinely and then maybe lucking into a stop every now and then isn't a defensive philosophy. It's just failing.
Yeah, and it's also like, oh, well, they only gave up 20 points. It's like they gave up 7 scores.
Right.
Like 7 field goals is bad.
It is bad, yes. That's correct.
Because one of those breaks.
Yeah, and teams do play just no bending or breaking. That is a thing that happens, especially with elite defenses. Yeah, you can do it. You don't, you know, there's some give and take here, but yes, that is a thing. Our defense is stupid. We all know that.
Mount Doom 98. While I understand the frustration with LaFleur sticking with Barry, I don't understand the calls to fire him. Am I mistaken in believing firing LaFleur would be detrimental to Love in his future? Yeah, I'm against firing LaFleur.
Yeah, I'm against firing LaFleur, too. I know that there's a segment of the population out there that does not like Matt LaFleur, but, you know, the quarterback development, the quick development of all these receivers, the play calling is very good. I don't think he's a perfect coach. I think he does lack a little bit something in the charisma department every once in a while. I could see him not being the best, like, rah-rah leader out there if you did need that for your team. But the offense, I mean, he's an offensive guy. The offense has developed wonderfully. Firing him would be stupid. You can, if you want, at the organizational perspective, make him fire his defensive coordinator. I know that we have this stupid bifurcated system and people are like, no, the front office can't fire. Yeah, they can. They absolutely can. They can change that by snapping their fingers. Like, that the front office is in charge of the coaching staff. And that is how that goes, no matter what Mark Murphy's claiming at the moment. Yep. So
all the, like, to go back to Thanos, right? The giant ginger snaps his fingers and something happens.
Yes, exactly.
Like that. That's just how it works. But yeah. If I am correct in my assessment of Joe Barry being back next year, but that I pray and hope I am not, then yeah, then we talk about it.
Yeah, but that's stupid. That's just dumb.
But that's also a clean house all the way up to the top because the fish rots from the head.
Yep.
Yeah. So I wouldn't fight. Yeah, but it would be very detrimental to love, I think, if we got rid of LaFleur now.
Yep.
Also, LaFleur's quote unquote, like, I guess lack of charisma is a good way to put it. Like not being the best rah-rah guy. I was reading an article about how handsome head coaches don't work because they didn't have to spend their lives developing charisma and like the ability to maintain a room.
Right.
Just because
everybody's nervous about talking to them. So they don't have to develop any strategies about talking.
Exactly.
Yep.
Yeah. So then you get like a dude who looks like a walrus and he's one of the best head coaches of all time.
Ah, well, that's fun.
Okay, Scott, one name, like Cher. Firing Barry now wouldn't do much other than satisfy fan bloodlust. So credit to LaFleur for showing mercy to a millionaire Nepo baby. It seems LaFleur's biggest weakness is being too nice to guys who try hard. BG literally had to cut Amari Rodgers to get LaFleur to stop using him. Is his ideal role not as head coach, but as McCarthy's next OC?
Ha, ha, ha. So first of all, I disagree that about the firing him wouldn't have helped. We actually have a lot of research on midseason firings of coordinators, offensive and defensive. And part of this is selection bias. Part of this is regression to the mean. If a guy sucked enough to get fired, that means he was doing badly. But you usually do get a pretty significant bump from in-season firings. Like, that does happen routinely. It is the norm for your defense to improve upon firing a bad defensive coordinator. They absolutely should have done it midseason. And not that I think they're legit Super Bowl contenders this year, but if you did happen to luck into, like, what the Vikings got with Brian Flores, who went from the 25th best defense to the 5th best defense overnight, combined with this offense development, you're suddenly a big power. Like, you are. So, you can't just piss away seasons by doing crap like this. And that's my problem here. It's too late now. There's 2 games left. But like with 5 games to go, you could have done it and it would have helped a lot. So it would help now, by the way. It absolutely would. It would be a Dale Swain move, but you could still do it and it would give them a bump on defense.
So if you take away the pure outlier of the Rams game and run
right,
DVOA
against the garbagiest quarterback of all time. Yes. Yeah.
So if you run DVOA off of the other games and you actually remove that week completely from the NFL, the Packers are the worst defense in the league by DVOA by a lot.
Yeah, they are.
So,
country.
Also, I think Scott's just being based on the millionaire Nepo baby comment. I think he's being tongue-in-cheek.
Tongue-in-cheek, yes. But also, you don't want Matt LaFleur as your offensive coordinator. You do want him as your head coach. I know charisma, yes, blah, blah, blah. You can hire guys for that, but you don't want to. One of the reasons I think, if I was betting long-term on the NFC North and how good everybody is, I think I would actually have the Vikings ahead of the Lions now. And that's not a big rip on the Lions because they've done a very, very, very good job and they're going to win the division and they've been good for a couple of years in a row. But I suspect they're going to lose Ben Johnson and he's going to get a head coaching job. And that will hurt the Lions a lot. And offensive coordinators in particular get stolen with regularity for head coaching jobs. Defensive coordinators tend not to quite as much. Defensive coordinators, even though we suck at it, tend to be more easily replaceable than offensive coordinators. Not for the Packers, maybe, but for most of the league. So, yeah, you want your guy as the head guy, your offensive guy as the head guy. That works better, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think of, like, the last truly successful defensive head coach. I mean, Belichick.
Not Belichick, but yes.
I mean, Belichick's the outlier, but, like, yeah, they're pretty much all offense.
Yep. True.
All right.
Yeah.
Bryce Trozen. Is there any chance that Barry revamps his scheme even somewhat to play against the Viking strengths? Or will we get the same old, same old? I'm going to take the late 90s indie scene for my album this week.
Oh, boy.
Keep It Like a Secret, Built to Spill in 1999. Because we'll probably never find out the other Jair incidents that led to his suspension. And we'll never know what Joe Barry has on Matt LaFleur that's kept him around so long.
There's a chance. Barry has done it every once in a while when prompted to by other people, usually. But, you know, you can't bet on it because a lot of the time it doesn't happen. So I hope it happens. It's very, very easy to game plan for Jaren Hall and Justin Jefferson and nothing else. It just
yeah,
is.
Well, I wonder if we're going to see a repeat of the Rams where you have just a god awful quarterback.
He's bad. His arm isn't Brett Rippon bad, though. Like, he actually has an NFL arm. He's not good, but.
I was terrified of Mullins because when you have a gunslinger out there,
yeah,
who like doesn't care that he's bad, he's going to break some.
Yeah, they should start Mullins. I know he threw 4 picks last week against Detroit, but like he can actually quarterback enough. And he's done this system enough well-ish that's your correct thing that you should be doing. Dobbs can't throw. He's a great athlete, but he can't throw. That's his big problem. Yeah. And he's smart as hell, apparently. You know, we all know that. He's the pastor not. This is the one where, like, you're just going off of, you have inexperience. You, this is too easy for the Packers. And they'll screw it up still, probably. But
also, people need to go watch that Detroit game. Mullins was out there playing like Brett Favre. Like, he was trying to make magic happen and forcing into tight windows, and it bit him.
He threw for 411 yards in that game. Like, he just, you know, a lot of them were to the other team, but that's
and
Nick
also the fourth pick was trying to force it to Justin Jefferson and, you know, trying to make something happen.
Yep.
Because 2 plays before that, he threw a magical pass to Justin Jefferson. So, there you go. Also, I don't know what Joe Barry has on Matt LaFleur.
No. Nope. They must be good friends.
I don't know. Maybe LaFleur and Marinelli are friends.
Family barbecue invite. Right.
Danny Noonan, who is less deserving of their current job, Joe Barry or Claudine Gay? Where does that UW lacrosse guy rank?
I don't know who Claudine Gay is, so I don't know. The answer is probably Joe Barry, though, because no one's less deserving of their job than Joe Barry.
Claudine Gay is the president of Harvard University.
Okay.
What'd she apparently do? Harvard is in a tailspin, I guess. I don't know.
Okay. I have no idea. UW lacrosse guy, I don't
keep up on the Ivy League comings and goings.
UW lacrosse guy. That one I know. The UW lacrosse chancellor or whatever, he recorded a pornographic film with a professor there or somebody else there. And so.
Well, he had multiples with his wife. And then he also, I guess, produced some films of other people.
Yeah. So the question there is, like, he is raising a First Amendment defense, just to lawyer for a second. That is not going to work. It is not a matter of public concern that those exist. And so the state, in its role as employer and not as state actor, can in fact fire people for that. It's why you can fire people for screwing up on the job, for, you know, cause, things like that. The First Amendment is not a get out of jail free card for this kind of thing, and he will not succeed here. So
also, I recall the bylaws saying something like can be terminated at any time for any reason.
Yeah.
And like he signed on the dotted line. Like those are the things that he accepted.
So like you can't be fired often college professors, especially at state schools, cannot be fired for teaching controversial topics. That is one area where the First Amendment does offer protection. But this is not that. So there you go. But Joe Barry is, you know, not a good employee. So I still put him below even that guy.
I mean, also, he's the UW lacrosse guy got let go for having a side hustle. Joe Barry can't even single hustle. All right. Patrick Detmer. I just listened to a second Packer-related podcast featuring JR from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
Oh, yeah.
My question is this. Is there anything that triggers the RAE hosts with the same level of rage as shown by Tom Silverstein, where JR mentions what Packer fans are saying on Twitter during the Green 19 fight?
Schadenfreude. It's come back around.
I love how JR is to Spoon what I am to JR.
Yep, that's the funny best thing.
Spoon's the best.
Yep, he is. But no, it's just ironic is all. It's great. And also everybody should listen to Green 19, especially while JR is doing it. It's fantastic.
Dutch Boy 5. Aaron Jones returned to form and it was nice to see. Dylan was looking better before the injury. Still thinking it's a very good tandem, and I know you can find a running back anywhere. What say you? How would you restructure Aaron Jones' contract to keep them both?
Oh, that's the toughest thing on this man. You can't, I don't think you, unless Aaron Jones is willing to take like a 1-year, not that many millions of dollars deal, which he will not, You can't do it. Like, you got to let him go. He's shown this year the injuries are starting to catch up to him. He's not a big back. He's awesome. He is awesome. And losing him will actually hurt. He is substantially better than most running backs. Thing is, like, most running backs aren't Aaron Jones. You can find the average running back very, very easily. But on all charts, like running over expected, explosive runs, like he's one of the best of the last like 10 years. He really is. Yeah, the only thing that holds him down is volume because he can't stay healthy. And even when he is healthy, they limit his touches to try and keep him healthy. So if you can get him to sign a stupid contract to bring him back for a year, that's great, but somebody's going to give Aaron too much money for too many years, and you're going to have to go find new ones.
His cap number next year is $17 million.
Yeah,
and he has 3 void years associated with the back half of his contract. So
maybe they do a 1 year and push that out. But you got to rip the bet. You can't give big money to a 30-year-old 200-pound running back. You just can't do it. Who runs between the tackles? Like.
Yeah, so he will be 30 next year, and he'll continue to be on the Packers payroll until he is 33.
Yeah,
huzzah! Yeah, I just don't see it. I think you can keep Dylan for pretty cheap.
Yeah, I think so too.
I don't see him going elsewhere.
They'll be drafting running backs this year, though. They absolutely will.
But I think keeping Dylan would keep Goot from spending too early on a running back.
Maybe.
Hopefully,
he's done it before, though. Dylan was a second rounder, but they had Aaron Jones, so and Jamal.
Yeah, but he was there to replace Jamal, right? Like, is there?
So keeping him won't stop him from drafting somebody too high to replace Aaron Jones.
I just talked myself out of it.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, keeping Dylan would keep them from drafting another big back early.
Yeah.
How's that?
That's good.
Prime Eddie Lacy. Speaking of big backs. I also have no further questions about this Packers team and generally am optimistic about our future with Love, LaFleur, the young receivers, and a new DC, Mike Zimmer, ? So in the holiday spirit, I was wondering, what were the formative experiences that made you guys Packers fans? Mine was watching Donovan McNabb drub the Jim Miller-led Bears in the playoffs at the tender age of 6 and joining my uncle's side of the Packers-Bears rivalry. Good move in hindsight.
I was just born into it in terms of my family watched every single week, even when they were absolutely awful in the 80s. I've seen a lot of bad Forrest Gregg called runs off tackle against much better teams. And I was kind of brainwashed, I guess, in that sense, because I was there for the horrible Packer teams, the kind of seasons that would make you leave for a different team. But I was long enough to get to the 1989 season, which was probably what solidified it for me. That season's great. That's the Don Majkowski season where they won a ton of come from behind games, where they actually turned into a good passing offense, where Sterling Sharp finally broke out and they beat the Bears. It was phenomenally fun. So probably that whole season is what did it for me. But I would watch even when they were running like Brent Fulwood off, you know, dive plays for the first 2 downs of every series. So
my dad's a Uper. And was born right on the border in a town called Bessemer. So it's like 8 miles from Wisconsin. Like Hurley, Wisconsin is on the border of Michigan. And his sister married a guy from Hurley, Wisconsin, my Uncle Mike. And my dad is a Bears fan, believe it or not. And so his brother-in-law thought it was hilarious to get his kid to say, "Go Pack, go," when he was 3. And around the time when I like had enough frontal lobe development to appreciate football, like on a more complex level, was the first year the Packers went to the Super Bowl. So it was the 96 season, like the magic of Brett Favre and going to the Super Bowl. And I got to stay up late and watch the Super Bowl. And we got a bunch of Little Caesars pizza and
that's a good time.
Like, and my team won. And then I started playing Pop Warner the next year. So it's like, you know, that was it, man. Like the thing that got me into football was the Packers. And then that just solidified from there.
Nice.
Yeah. All right. Matt Pickett. Given how far below his usual standard Jair's performance has been this season, are we really that much worse off without him this week? And speaking of Jair, which party in this situation do you most identify with? The cocky, emboldened aggressor, the disrespected nice guy, the stern parent who has to put their foot down, the amused teammates siding with the clown, or the teammates that are ignoring the whole thing?
I'll bet the teammates are not ignoring the whole thing. And I guess I'm probably more on stern parent side, but I would say even more on someone else's parent watching someone else's family have a big problem and being very judgy about it. Because I feel like, first of all, Alexander should be punished for that. He shouldn't have been running out to make himself the captain and almost screwing up the coin toss, which would have been quite tragic. And the thing is, I suspect this is not all, that was not a single event. I suspect that was the culmination of a lot of things coming together and could have been addressed earlier behind closed doors before it became a big public thing. So I'm very much a parent, but I think a parent of a different family watching a playground fight that I wouldn't allow to happen to my own family.
Yeah, I'm exact same way. Like I feel like we're sitting back and watching like passive aggressive gentle parenting.
Yeah,
and it's just like, man, that's gonna come back and bite you, dude.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Also, I don't know if Jair is a detriment out there. You know, I think 80% Jair is still third best corner.
Yeah, I think so too. It's hard to tell when he's hurt. And depending on how he's hurt, like we've seen him shut down Justin Jefferson before when allowed to actually like play aggressive man against him. If you had him out there, you could theoretically do that. The question is he actually right enough to do it? And is Joe Barry smart enough to actually call it correctly? And who knows? No freaking clue. No idea.
Yeah. Well, you know, let's just see some Mabel out there, right? Give me a man look on the single wide receiver side and zone on the bunch. And hope that Justin Jefferson isn't in the okay. Danish Cheesehead. So suddenly Bo Melton had a pretty solid game.
Yeah.
What does Paul's Black Magic Excel sheet have to say about this?
Bo Melton sucks. And that's what my sheet says about him. in 2021, I ranked, 332 receivers by ROPS. He was 300. And the reason he was 300 for Rutgers is that, first of all, Bo Melton, very, very, very fast. I believe he's an Iron Razz guy, but he's tiny. He's a teeny tiny fast guy and played at Rutgers. Here's the thing. He caught a very, very low number of his targets, which you might blame on Rutgers quarterbacks. Fine. But he also was super non-explosive, one of the least explosive players in Division I football. He is ranked down by the running backs in yards per catch. That is not where you want to be as a fast guy. And that is kind of what he looks like at the NFL level. Like, he had a decent enough game last game, had some nice catches, but he's a big fast guy. Or not big, he's a fast guy. He's supposed to be explosive, and he's not. He's a non-explosive small guy, and, you know, it's not going to work. It's fine if you want to keep him around for your sixth receiver. Okay. He apparently works very hard. He shows up. He's good on special teams, all that stuff. It's good having those guys around, but he's not going to turn into anything. There are very few receivers as bad as him who ended up making the NFL.
He's also a straight line burner.
Straight line burner, totally. Short straight line burner is hard in the NFL.
Yeah, his three cone is barely breaks seven. Like we've got outside linebackers who are more agile than that. Yeah, and he's 5'11", 190.
Yeah,
like that's a dude who's going to get blown off the line if he has to actually go against an NFL press.
All correct.
Yeah. Second half of his question, and Romeo Doubs looking more serviceable?
Romeo has been pretty good lately. I don't think he's a legit number one, but he's been a good possession receiver. It would be nice if he would ever catch a ball cleanly in his life. He has, let's see, I got splits here. He has been quite a bit better lately in the second half of the season and really boosted that yards per catch from, honestly, execrable, terrible levels to something much more serviceable at 11.5. That is primarily because of big games against Kansas City, where he averaged 18 yards a catch just last game against Carolina, because he had that one big catch that made him up to 20. He's had a couple nice 12s against Detroit and the Rams in there, too. So he's been okay. His numbers actually now look halfway decent. I still think he's kind of just... He's better than like Bo Melton, but I think he's kind of just a guy. He's a nice number two and number three, but he's stretched as a one. So hopefully the rest of the guys keep playing better and keep him as a two or three where he can actually be serviceable.
But he can at least play on the outside.
He can.
We know that. It's nice. He's a serviceable outside receiver, not just another slot guy.
Yeah, I'll take that.
Scarf 21. LaFleur continues to stick his neck out to defend Barry, even seemingly throwing the offense under the bus to avoid holding the defense accountable. How concerned are you that he will inexplicably bring back Barry in 24? As frustrated as he seems on a weekly basis, Matt seems to be doing everything in his power to avoid holding Barry accountable. Sub question, is the suffering we must endure watching the Packers defense the price we must pay to maintain equilibrium in the universe as Tucker Kraft shatters the third round curse?
Sure. Yes. Good on Tucker Kraft for that.
I'm not calling that yet, by the way.
Oh, the bet's not over. Absolutely not. Like, yeah.
No. I'm saying specifically the third round curse.
Yeah.
I ain't calling that because the last third round curse breaker his neck. So it's not
fair. Okay.
JerMichael Finley suddenly became very good and then broke his neck.
Then broke his neck. That's true. So what do we got to give him, like three seasons to call it broken?
Yeah. So he has to be good for his rookie contract, sign a second contract that is not super crazy expensive.
Okay.
And that's, to me, that's a broken third round. Yes.
Yeah. Gotcha. All right. Fair enough.
But as for the, so we're also doing a lot of assumptions here with Barry being out, in that 99 times out of 100 coordinators are on 3-year contracts. This is the third year of his contract. I cannot find any definitive proof that it's a 3-year contract.
Okay.
So
we don't know. All right.
We are all under the assumption that this is the last year of his contract. And that seems to be like the general consensus. However, I still haven't seen any concrete.
They can't bring him back. They cannot.
Yeah. Hopefully.
Hopefully.
But, you know.
He's really bad.
And also, if he did sign a 4-year contract, like, out of nowhere, and he is back next year, I take no pleasure in that.
Yeah. It would be annoying for me, but for both of us.
Ryan Ziegler, how far is Joe Flacco going to take the Browns, and what the hell are they going to do with Watson's contract?
Eat it. No choice there.
Well, folks, we are 3 days away at the time of recording from Joe Flacco unleashing his superpower. Do you know Joe Flacco's nickname?
No.
January Joe.
That makes sense.
Because Joe Flacco in the playoffs is a menace.
He goes on a burner once in a while. He does. Big arm still there. That's the thing about Joe. Like, a lot of these old guys come back and they're just like savvy veteran, weak arm guys at this point. Joe's out there like playing Brett Favre lights. He's winging it down the field. It's fun.
Also, Flacco is one of the last good statuesque quarterbacks. I'm not going to say, like, in terms of, like, you know, he's very tall. He's not terribly mobile. And he knows how to torque his body to throw the ball far and hard.
They might go far. Like, they're probably a good dark horse candidate because the Browns' personnel is great. Like, their defense is one of the best in the league, if not the best in the league. And they have great skill position players. They just have had garbage quarterbacking. And now they have, you know, averagey quarterbacking. They might go far, honestly.
So, I'm not Joe Flacco. Them. Well, Joe Flacco has thrown 13 touchdown passes in the last 5 games.
Yep.
Which is more than I think 4 or 5 teams have thrown all year.
Yeah, definitely is. I think the Jets only have like 12. The guy who got 11. Cut for 11. The guy who got cut for Aaron getting activated had one of the 11. I remember when the stat came out and everybody was like, 11.
Yeah. Well, that was a conspiracy theory, Paul. Don't talk about that.
Yeah, of course.
But yeah, the Browns to me are a terrifying team.
Yep, I wouldn't want to play them in the playoffs. And if you are a higher ranked team, you don't want to run into them in the playoffs at all.
But they also still have a shot at taking the AFC North
they do.
And playing a home game, and that would just be murderous for basically anybody else, except for maybe the Ravens.
Yeah, and as for Watson, I think he's washed, and you just gotta eat it. Like, you gotta keep him on the bench for years and not play him, and that's it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's what they did with Osweiler.
Yep,
they got a second round pick to eat Osweiler's $70 million contract.
That's right.
And they're, so it's not something they're,
you give Deshaun Watson that much money, you get what you deserve. That's what's happening there.
K-7. The Packers should be committed to discipline and winning. This team should have a standard. A suspension for a game makes sense. So suspend Joe Barry for one game. Seriously, I realize that this is not apples to apples. However, how do we reconcile holding a professional football player to a team standard but his coach to no standard at all.
It's how you lose
rules
locker
for
room.
Thee. Yeah. I was going to say rules for thee, not for me.
Yep. It is how you lose locker room though. And Jair, what he did was out of the ordinary. And so a punishment is probably warranted. But I mean, you're right. It's hard to hold anybody to a standard on the field if you're not holding your coordinator to a standard on the field. And it's how you lose people. And we've talked about that a lot lately. And it is a problem. Monitoring the Packer locker room is worth doing. I think they have a potential bubbling problem there.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, you've even got people on the offense out there doing the cryptic Instagram thing, showing support for Jair. Yeah, it's not just the defense at this point.
Yep.
Flaley Joel Osment, in your defensive strategy, 60% of the time it works every time, then maybe it's bad. Paul has explained the year-to-year variance in defensive schemes, but what kind of expectation should there be in season? And is how many SDs are average versus abnormal?
Not SDs? Sure. Does he mean defensive coordinators? Shoot.
It's...
We'll do our best, Flaley. I'm not sure what SDs is, but I think I have a decent heuristic for this, which is your defensive coordinator, you should expect to vary by about 10 to 12 spots a year, which is very large. And in season, the way that you should assess it, first of all, is that you should use point differential or something like it, a more advanced point differential if you want, or DVOA, versus actual record. Like, you should keep an actual... good metric for how the defense is performing. Try to take out as much luck as possible. And you should adjust for injuries too. Like, if you are, you can't expect to be completely healthy, but you should have a metric for what you expect given average injuries. And if your team is decimated by injuries, you should cut your defensive coordinator a lot of slack because there's only so much they can do. But the thing about Joe Barry that we have a lot of data on is he's never good. He's always a bottom defensive coordinator, and he bops around a little bit in the 20s, but he never gets above 15. It just never happens with him. So if your defensive coordinator is like, if you're like, you know, 4, then 8, then like you bop down to like 14 for a season, I don't think that's cause for concern, and you should be patient with your DC. If that continues, then you stick in the bottom half. But like 14 is just a normal bit of variance for any given defensive coordinator who is like a top half coordinator. That's going to happen sometimes.
And also, there will be like an explainable metric if they are a top 10 consistently and drop down to the mid level. You'll be like, oh, they're not forcing turnovers anymore.
Yeah, something like that will show up. And turnovers are very random. Fumble recoveries are very random. You can pick out these little things that cause defenses to underperform very easily. Cluster luck. We talk about that a lot on the baseball podcast. But having a lot of your success on defense on first or second down and then not on third down. That is often a bit of randomness that will come back to the mean eventually. It's not always. Some guys actually suck on third down. I actually think Joe Barry sucks on third down for real. But most teams put a consistent defensive effort across all the downs, and their success doesn't lump with where you would expect it to, and it costs them. So you can usually pick out why they've struggled and tell if it's luck or something else. But yeah. That's that. As for SDs, average versus abnormal, I'm not sure.
Is this like a D's Nuts joke that we're missing and like we're gonna get a
maybe it is.
Week
it could be. It's a good setup, honestly. If so. So we'll see if we get that next year. Next week. All right. That's it.
No, next year.
Next year. We will get it next year, you're right. All right. On that note, Matt, happy new year. Anything you wanna plug real quick before we get out of here?
So my betting content continues to get more and more unhinged as the season progresses.
Oh, yeah, that was good.
And if the Packers get mathematically eliminated, I am just going to write the most ridiculous articles humanly possible.
Excellent.
As always, call your best friend, tell him you love him, open your best bottles, life is short. I got to try Pappy 15 for the first time.
Oh, man.
Night.
All right. How was it? Live up to your expectations or just a bourbon that costs a lot?
I finally understand the law of diminishing returns as it relates to that hobby.
Yeah.
Van Winkle 10 is phenomenal. Van Winkle 15 is only slightly better. It is not twice as good.
Got it. All right. Makes sense. As for me, I got something up on Acme Packing Company right now, and I got something with the Shepherd Express recapping that last terrible game that happened, so go check that out. And I think we'll be back next week at a normal-ish time to do the podcast, and everything will return to normal-ish. Hopefully we'll have something to play for and not get eliminated. That would be lovely. but who knows what we'll have in store for us here. So, happy New Year, everybody. Stay safe. Enjoy the game.
Why can't they all be Minnesota girls? I'm sorry, Brian Wilson, but you were wrong.